Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is the New Books Network Seminar. Welcome to the podcast, and thanks very much for joining me here today. I just finished talking with Ken Wark about his new book, Molecular Red, Theory for the Anthropocene. This came out with Verso in 2015, and it's a book that I'm really excited to share with you, in part because it's so widely relevant and applicable and useful for thinking about and with so many different fields. This is really a book that transcends discipline and field, and this is one of the reasons that we're featuring it on the seminar. So what the book does is give us a way to think with and perhaps create a way to practice theory for and in the Anthropocene. And it does this by creating a conversation between two bodies of work, two kinds of work at least, that might not often be put into conversation with one another. The first body of work occupies part one of the book, and this takes us into a Soviet context by looking very closely at the practices, the literature, the work, the fiction, and the nonfiction of Alexander Bogdanov and Andrei Platonov. You'll see in this part of the book and in this part of the conversation very briefly the ways that Bogdanov's work kind of sets up some tools, perhaps some apparatus, to use a term that'll come up later, for thinking with and practicing what comes later. Now, this is articulated in the book with the second part of the book, which takes us into the world of science studies and of science fiction. And in the second part of the book, we look in detail at the work of Paul Feyerabend, of Donna Haraway, of Paul Edwards, of Karen Barad, and also the science fiction of Kim Stanley Robinson. So the book begins and ends in a way with Mars, in two very different contexts, in two very different ways, and it also threads together the work and the ideas of these potentially very different kinds of authors, practitioners, into a way of thinking about and practicing, I think, intellectual and scholarly and philosophical and theoretical and other kinds of tools for dealing with where we are now in the Anthropocene, where we might be as we move forward. It's also a really, really smooth, really pleasurable read, and so I highly recommend this, not just to people who are interested in and practitioners of science studies, not just to people who like science fiction, not just to people who want to read about the Soviet context, but really anyone who is interested in anything. This is a book for you if you are a person who is interested in things. So with that, I will leave you to it and just thank you as ever for listening and for your support of the channel. I hope you enjoy. I'm here today to talk with Mackenzie Wark about his new book, Molecular Red. Welcome to the New Books Network Seminar, Ken, and thanks very much for both writing a book that I think is of wide transdisciplinary, interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary interest, and also for making time to talk with me about it today. I'm really looking forward, and welcome.
Thank you, Carla. A pleasure.
So let's start big, just to give listeners a sense of the context within which to situate this particular project. What are you typically writing about and working on when you're not writing works of theory for the Anthropocene?
Well, I guess I'm a scholar of media studies and of culture, and those are things that I've written about in the past. And I think I've always been interested in how forms of scholarship can address issues that come from without, that aren't things generated by our own internal agendas, but are sort of thrown at us by the world. And it seemed more than high time to sort of address a series of Earth system phenomena that are widely known as the Anthropocene, and to sort of think, well, you know, what in the sort of traditions that I know and work in have we overlooked that might already be feeling their way towards something like that? So going back through the critical theory tradition that I know, it's like it was always off to the side. And so I sort of tried to find some people that I thought we could construct as a like a some sort of platform in the mud to stand on, to sort of think about this in the present.
So the book that we're talking about today is in many ways, and we can talk about this perhaps in the conversation to come, practicing the kind of practice that it also celebrates and brings us into. And that is, it's very much breaking down boundaries and creating commonalities and conversations among works and individuals and ideas and practices that listeners may not have previously come into contact with as part of a common conversation. So the first part of the book takes us into a Russian literary context, a Soviet context, and the second part of the book takes us into California. So as in order to understand a little bit about the genesis of the project, but also of the book, right, as an object, can you talk a little bit about your choice to create these particular kinds of conversations? Why the Soviet and the Californian context as a way to create this object and create these kinds of conversations?
I think one of the things that the Anthropocene puts on the agenda for everybody, but including scholars in the humanities, is thinking at scale. So it's about big things. It's about large systems. And in, you know, the history of the modern world, there are really two extraordinary examples of, call them what you like, maybe they're even civilizations that thought at scale. And one was the United States or the free world or the West, and the other was the Soviet Union, was its great rival. And the Cold War narrative is sort of about one defeats the other. But the Cold War's over, so maybe there are other ways of thinking about these two, you know, vast civilizations. And maybe the story is more that, you know, one of them failed, and we have some good, you know, good clues about why and how it failed. But the other is failing, and we don't really have ways of thinking about the sort of decline and unraveling of, you know, call it what you like, you know, global capitalism, whatever it is. It kind of really can't go on chewing through resources at the speed with which it has. Some kind of qualitative phase change has to happen. So it struck me as maybe useful to think about a previous attempt at a qualitative change in a vast modern civilization, that was the Soviet Union, and that didn't work, to kind of figure out other things we could learn about how to not do that another time around.
And I think one of the things that comes out of the experience of reading the book, at least my experience as one reader, right, that's all I can really speak to, is that it also helps reframe perhaps how we understand what it is to not work, right? And maybe it can work now in different contexts, in different kinds of conversations, in a really, I think, interesting way. And I think we can perhaps get to that. So the book opens, the preface opens with an epigraph from the Cyborg International. This is also how the book closes. Workings of the world untie. You have a win to world, right? It brings us into a kind of introduction for the project. And I want to just kind of mention in the words of the book a moment that perhaps can bring us into it and help us start opening up the book. The preface says, "This is the end of prehistory. This moment when planetary constraints start really coming to bear on the ever-expanding universe of the commodification of everything. It's not the end of the world, but it is the end of prehistory." Okay, so as a historian, this is something that I was very interested in. Can you maybe start us off in our exploration of the book by talking about this idea of prehistory? What does it mean to say that this is the end of prehistory, and what's important for us to understand about that in order to launch into what comes kind of next in the book?
One of the problems with trying to think about the Anthropocene is grappling with models of temporality. So are there ways of sort of detaching it from notions of apocalypse, for example? Because I don't find that terribly useful. So I thought, well, why not look at the sort of it's not a sophisticated, it's more of a bog Hegelian way of understanding a turning point in time, which for Hegel himself might have been French Revolution, or more famously for Fukuyama, it's liberal democratic capitalism is the end of history, or the end of prehistory, if you like. And so what if we thought of the kind of discovery of a world Earth system constraint on the ever-expanding horizons of modernity as the end of prehistory, and how would we then start to rethink you know, what time is and how we're situated in time and that sort of thing. So that's sort of the opening conceit, if you like.
So the book understands a central theme of the Anthropocene to be the story of what you call the Carbon Liberation Front. So I have to ask you this, right? What's the Carbon Liberation Front, and what's the importance of that for us to understand the project?
Yeah, and it doesn't maybe rise much above the level of a bad joke, but...
That's okay. I like that level. That's a good level to stay with.
Yeah. You know, what really got liberated by modernity? Like, liberation is one of the great themes of modern thought, right? But what we really clearly succeeded in liberating more than anything else, and I use we in inverted commas, is carbon. We just liberated enormous quantities of the stuff, particularly those of us who live in Western industrialized parts of this civilization. So what if we thought that the most successful liberation movement on the planet was the Carbon Liberation Front, which is, you know, somehow extracting vast quantities of itself out of the lithosphere and putting it in the atmosphere. But it's probably not a good liberation movement. It's kind of problematic for the rest of us. And by us, I kind of mean, you know, the biosphere. What if we thought of a non-human actor as being the one that had really succeeded in that period?
Now, the book also introduces the Anthropocene as a series of, and this is inspired by Marx, metabolic rifts. The book in the preface takes us into a way of understanding labor as it extracts molecular flows from the world, from rocks, from soil, from animals, from plants, but these flows don't return back from whence they came, and thus a metabolic rift. Now, I mentioned this idea of molecular flows, and the idea of molecular, right, becomes really important throughout the book, and we'll get to this later as well. It's also in the title. So let's talk a little bit about that just to orient listeners. You talk early in the book about organizing assemblages in a molar mode versus a molecular mode. So when we talk about molecular modes here and the importance of the molecular as it orients the study, what are we talking about? Can you talk a little bit about that for listeners?
Yeah, and that one's maybe a bit inside baseball, in the sense that the molar molecular comes from the philosopher Gilles Deleuze and his collaborations with Félix Guattari, and it's sort of thinking like very broadly the difference between you thinking about things that have bodies and identities versus things that are flows that traverse it. So that's molar, you know, things that have big bodies, and molecular, the sort of infinitesimal flows through and that bypass them. But for them, they talk about molecular metaphorically, and I wanted to take it completely literally. So it really is about flows of carbon and phosphorus and nitrogen and the compounds that they find themselves in. So what if we took, you know, the molecular to be quite sort of literally something going on that passes through Earth systems and human systems as well, and adopted that perspective. And I got molecular rift from John Bellamy Foster, who in turn gets it from Marx's Capital Volume 3, where Marx is sort of grappling with the soil science of the time and starting to think through this metaphor of metabolism as being more than what happens in an individual body, but happens in a whole sort of agricultural industrial system. And from von Liebig, he gets the idea of a rift of, you know, well, you're extracting nitrogen and phosphorus from the soil, and it's in the food, and the people eat the food, and the people pee it down the drain in the city, and it doesn't go back where it came from. And therefore, you need fertilizer. And for a fertilizer, you need colonialism to go get it. And if you can't get it, then you can find scientific ways of replacing it and so on. But maybe that doesn't always go on forever, and you end up with rifts that just get wider and wider. And with carbon, that really does seem to be the situation. But maybe with some others. Some people talk about peak phosphorus. I don't know if that's really true, that extractable phosphorus is in short supply. But it's a question one would start to ask, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. So once we have this kind of foundation to build on, we move to part one of the book. This is Labor and Nature. And we're going to go through this at a fairly rapid clip, but I think it's important for us to touch on at least some of the notions and foundations that are going to animate the second part of the book. So chapter one of the book brings us into the work and the practices and the ideas of Alexander Bogdanov. Now, at one point, Bogdanov was Lenin's rival for leadership of the Bolsheviks, as you tell us here in this part of the book, but he goes on to develop what you call a radical practice of knowledge. And he does this by focusing on the importance of labor in Marx. You tell us that the central proposition of Bogdanov's thought is that our species being is as builders of worlds. Now, this motivates not just a way to understand the importance of labor, but also the nature of nature, right? What is nature? Nature here is that which labor encounters. Okay, so he draws on the work of Ernst Mach, and I just mentioned that because we're going to come back to Ernst Mach when we come to the second part of the book, and in part he's thinking about practices of knowledge in terms of sensation and the importance of sensation, and we'll come back to that as well. Okay, so that's all foundation, but it leads me into a question about one of the central notions and practices that you introduce through Bogdanov's work and in this part of the book, and that's a practice called tectology. This is a way of thinking about and practicing how labor can organize knowledge. So to give listeners a sense of the nature and importance of this notion, Ken, can you talk a little bit about tectology? What do we need to understand about how you are conceptualizing that in order to understand the work of the rest of the book?
Well, Bogdanov struck me as interesting as one of those neglected figures. And if you think of the archive as being like a maze with all of these like hidden little corners, rather than being sort of like some great canonic succession of you read this person, then you read this other person. So I'm always interested in those people off to the side a little bit, and he's one of those. There's certain worlds where he's well known, of course, but I think to the general reader, he's a bit of a kind of minor figure. He was trained in the natural sciences. He was a physician and very, very interested in what was going on in all of the sciences at his time. He tried to keep abreast of that. And he wants a version of materialism that's adaptable to what the sciences throw at it, rather than a version of materialism that's just a sort of abstract philosophical concept. So for him, the thing that's really crucial is the labor of producing knowledge and the labor of producing the world. So it's a realism of the practice of producing knowledge and the practice of producing the world. Like that would be the one way of defining the kind of philosophy he's trying to produce. And there are a few concepts that struck me as interesting. He borrows tectology, I think, from Ernst Haeckel. And for him, it's a way in which different kinds of knowledge can cooperate with each other. So how is it we can, in doing one kind of labor or one kind of science or one kind of humanitarian knowledge, can we sort of produce a diagram or a concept or something that it might be useful in another field? So how do we get it from one field to another? And he thinks it's a two-part practice, and one is sort of extracting some kind of diagram or metaphor from what one does in place A, being able to move it across to place B, and then experimentally testing it there. So he thinks that we do this unconsciously all the time, that a lot of our worldview is made up of just generalized things from our daily life or our labor practice that we unconsciously project onto the world. And what he wants is a conscious practice of where you do that, but you test it. You test whether it's really the case that things look like that when you start to produce knowledge in a different place.
Mm-hmm. Now, how does the notion of the prolet cult come into play here? What is that, and what's the significance of that in this context?
So the thing he's best known for is Prolet Cult, which was an organization that he founded actually just before the October Revolution, and it sort of gets shut down by Lenin in the early 20s. And the idea was that it would be a kind of an alternative form of power to the party, the state, and the trade unions that would be the self-production of workers' culture. So is there a way that you could develop a culture out of the practices of labor itself? Like, that was the sort of the grand ambition of it. And at its peak, it was a mass organization with possibly hundreds of thousands of members. The historiography on this is not complete, although there's a couple of good books on it. So for a moment, it was this sort of rival organization to other forms of organization in the Soviet Union. I think Bogdanov thought that, whatever the revolution was, for Bogdanov, it was going to take an incredibly long time. And the main thing for him was the struggle between labor and nature. Everything else was secondary. And the struggle between labor and nature is one you never win. It's a question of continually adapting. And is there a way that you could better use the resources of the world, better organize in a kind of adaptive and flexible, egalitarian and comradely way? That was his whole deal. That was his whole project.
Great. Now, if we follow a path through the rest of this chapter, in a way that we won't talk about in any detail, but in a way that takes us into Hamlet, Shakespeare, right? It takes us into a really fascinating account of Bogdanov's work with blood exchange. He actually dies, right, as a result of blood exchange with a student who had a form of tuberculosis. So that's a really, really interesting material part of the story. The path leads us to Andrei Platonov. This is a prolet cult writer who actually, as you describe here in the book, pulls off something of what Bogdanov suggested. Now, his work becomes important for lots of reasons, but insofar for us, at least in part, as it introduces the importance of the point of view of comrades to what's going on here. So what's going on with that? What do we need to know about Platonov and how he's bringing comrades and comradeship into the story before we move on?
Well, for Bogdanov, the goal was a way of organizing knowledge that's comradely. So it's not based on authority or exchange. It's based on some kind of sharing. And then comrade has a slightly different meaning in Platonov. He thinks we're only comrades when we face the same dangers. And so the implied critique of what had happened in the Soviet Union was that was just clearly not true. Danger fell very unequally on different kinds of bodies. And he was that rare thing, a genuine proletarian modernist writer and one of the greats of that period, but who he was caught up in the Civil War and witnessed the famine and gave up writing for a while and retrained as an engineer and got to see what was going on in the countryside in the Soviet Union from that point of view, as someone sent out not as a writer but as an engineer, and starts writing a magnificent series of I think they're a kind of anti-literature that attempts to sort of sum up the experience of the struggle to produce at the base level the means of a new civilization. And very early on, I think Platonov sees it not happening, not working. There's a famous book called Foundation Pit, and it's all about just digging a deeper and deeper pit for a building that will never happen over the top of it. Mm-hmm. So it's this history in a tragic mode seen from below. He has many influences besides Bogdanov. I just wanted to emphasize that connection because for Platonov, it's all about labor's struggle with nature, but where nature is not providence, nature is not our friend, nature is not bounty, it's poverty. So the poverty of the encounter is just kind of a great theme in Platonov. And it struck me as very contemporary. It struck me as what the experience of life on the world is for most of us who don't live the kind of lucky first world lives that we do. Like, he's already writing for a planet of orphans, which is the planet we've produced.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Now, Foundation Pit is one of several works that the chapter takes us into in really beautiful detail. It's a fascinating chapter. And it also introduces one of the works that you talk about here, Shevangor, as not just a historical novel, but also a kind of utopia. And this figure of the utopia is something that will follow through into part two of the book. So part two of the book takes us into California. It takes us from the Soviet context into the U.S. context, and it takes us into the space of science and utopia, as it's called. The third chapter introduces us to this Californian context by introducing us to, you've pretty much hit on like a whole bunch of the people I just really like to read. So I was really thrilled by these chapters. I was super psyched about this. So you start by taking us into the work of Paul Feyerabend. Okay, so Paul Feyerabend is one of the philosophers who brought me into an interest in philosophy and philosophy of science in the first place. I totally dig him, and I totally dug that you brought him into this book. So let's talk a little bit about Paul Feyerabend. What makes for you his work as you call him, a Dadaist soul? What makes his work so interesting in this context for you?
Well, I should say there, just as I'm no expert on Soviet literature, I'm no expert on Feyerabend either. But there are a couple of things that struck me as really key to a kind of a turn in the study of science that he's identified with. And I concentrated less on the famous book Against Method and a little bit more on some things he'd said about Ernst Mach. And he, I think, did a really brilliant job of sort of rescuing the reputation of Mach, who is often thought of as like the guy who didn't believe in the atom and all this sort of thing. And there are a lot of very unhelpful ways in which he's been presented. And he does a sort of very careful working through of what Mach was trying to do. And to show that, and the other thing is, Mach is often seen as where logical positivism came from. And it's true that that started out as the Mach society, but Mach himself was a different kind of practitioner. So he was a physicist, but very much interested in the physical sciences and in sensation. And sensation's a really key category. And Mach very much wanted to have done with the sort of overburden of a kind of massive metaphysics that tended to surround the sciences. And occasionally would generate metaphors that lead people to investigate things and actually find them, but very often also mislead people and remain a kind of, kind of fantasy that there could be a sort of theory of everything. Feyerabend is kind of interested in that aspect of Mach that on the one hand sort of pars, the sort of role of philosophy down to size in relation to science, but keeps it open as a kind of creative faculty, as one that, firstly limits the conceptual apparatus that we think sensation through. But on the other hand, there's that sort of little Dada-esque capacity there to, find the productive metaphor to sort of make the leap that's really not quite there in the results or whatever, that's productive and that's creative. So to me, Feyerabend's reading of Mach was really useful for demonstrating that Bogdanov's reading of Mach also had some merit to it, in the more or less century before. So it just struck me there's a little nexus there worth investigating.
Great. Now, one of the really interesting things that comes out of your treatment of Feyerabend's work here is he's kind of more than many other philosophers of science do, right? There are others who do, but not a whole lot. He's reorienting us to look at what people actually do, right? What people actually experience, what people actually feel, what people actually, as an important and legitimate part of what we're doing when we do philosophy, right? As the perhaps important part of what we're doing when we do philosophy. And this is a sensibility and a form of practice that's shared with or that's shared by the next point in our itinerary here as we move through this chapter, and that's feminist science studies. So as you put it here in the book, feminist science studies shares with Bogdanov, in the words of the book, a commitment to studying the reality of the process of the production and reproduction of knowledge. So again, it gets us in the soil here, looking at and taking seriously what people actually do, right? Not this kind of formal projection of what we idealize as the doing of things or the thinking of things. So in encountering feminist science studies here, we encounter the work of not just Donna Haraway, but Cyborg Haraway as well. So let's start with Cyborg Haraway and then move to Donna Haraway. What is Cyborg Haraway for you? Can you just basically briefly talk about that, and then we can move to Donna Haraway?
Right. And to take a little step backwards to go forward. So oh, sure. For Bogdanov, what's crucial about Marx is it's all about the labor point of view. For Bogdanov, that's the absolutely central thing. So Marxism isn't a philosophy. It's you know, an orientation to the labor point of view. And so in the second half of the book, I've got a sort of slightly cheeky reading of Feyerabend and Haraway and others as sort of updating, you know, how do you think the labor point of view in the 21st century? Cyborg Haraway is a way of doing a couple of things. And one is that, labor is kind of inhuman. It's always a mix of the human and the machinic. What produces the social means of subsistence is not people alone. It's a kind of cyborgian mix. So that's sort of one of the senses that I wanted to get out of it. And the other is that Bogdanov, like, astonishingly says that, you know, Marx's Capital is collaboratively written by Marx and the labor movement. And there's a sense in which that's actually sort of true when you look through the footnotes. And I was interested in the way that Bogdanov really wanted to create collaborative practices of knowing the world. And he attempted that and was sort of shut down. But if there's anything that looks a little bit like what he tried to do in the current, sort of intellectual landscape, it was History of Consciousness in California, a program that Donna Haraway didn't start, but it is sort of famously one of the central people in. And it struck me that she was part of a kind of really interesting network, you know, not just of people, but of practices, of producing knowledges that could move between the humanities and the sciences in really interesting ways. And so I wanted to sort of make that the subject, in a sense, of the second half of the book.
Great. In approach, in thinking about sort of Cyborg Haraway, it reminds me in a way of the really, I think, exciting work of another STS scholar, Hélène Miollet, who wrote this book about mm-hmm. Stephen Hawking, like as an assemblage, basically, Hawking mm-hmm. Incorporated. So I think there's some really, really, I think, generative, productive things about thinking in terms of assemblage and not in terms of just single authors, you know, being geniuses mm. and sitting at their desk, that I think this is a big part of. So let's move to Haraway's work, right, as you engage it here. For you, and I'm going to keep this super open and just invite you to occupy this space in whatever way you'd like, what are some of the most important ways that Haraway's work helps create this conversation with that, or with the work of Bogdanov? Like, what are these points of coming together that for you might most excitingly point a way forward and things that we can actually work with?
I mean, Haraway is writing in such a different context mm-hmm. of you know, the sort of hyper-developed California from the 80s to the present is such a different context to what the Soviet Union was. But you can ask in a much more contemporary and sophisticated way, who or what collaborates to make the world? And Haraway enables you to say, both women and men, racialized subjects, not only humans but other species, extraordinary collaborations between the human and the technical, and to ask at the same time questions about how power works through all of that, that there are, sort of massive inequalities in how that apparatus has come to be. So it struck me that it was possible to read that as a kind of update on what Bogdanov was doing. And there's no direct connection between them, but Haraway had read people who had read people who had read people who read Bogdanov and Marx. So it kind of makes sense, and it doesn't matter to me if I can really show there's a strong genealogy connecting them.
Oh, of course.
It's kind of like it's kind of like an echo. It's like people rediscovering the same problems, but in a different language, in a more contemporary language. And it struck me it was worth drawing this Marxist literature and Haraway back together, that without gainsaying what's important about the contribution of feminist science studies. Like, it's not an either or, that you can sort of thread those things back together a bit more.
And actually, you just mentioned a term that leads us really nicely into what I wanted to ask you about next, the term apparatus, right? But first, I just want to mark the fact that this is one of the ways and one of the moments in which I think the book does actually practice what it talks about, right? I don't want to say preaches, because it's not, you know, really preaching, but in moving from a way of assuming that what it is to create a conversation among ideas and people and work is to identify a genealogy to something that looks more like creating a conversation through what you talk about when you talk in the next book or in the next section about Barad's work through diffraction, right? This is very much what the book is doing, and it's also what the book in the next section is talking about doing. So I think it's actually really productive and important, not just for how your book contributes to science studies and well beyond, but also for how we think about this to move away from the assumption that working from and with genealogy is the only way to have a conversation or necessarily the best or the most productive way. So diffraction. So as we move from Haraway onward, we move into the work of another scholar whose work I absolutely love. This is Karen Barad. So you introduce the importance of Barad's work in part by introducing, as I just mentioned, this idea of diffraction. You say she borrows this from Haraway, but then she kind of extends it. So can you talk a little bit about that? Because as I think I've, you know, hopefully made clear, I think that's a really important notion, not just for the for what you're talking about here in the book, but also for the kind of work that the book is doing.
Yeah, there's a way in which theories of knowledge or epistemologies really tend to sort of get bogged down in ideas of representation. And diffraction or refraction struck me as interesting in the sense that to think about sort of indirect or indexical ways of that knowledges of the world can be produced, that we don't always have representations of the world, that sensation can be very indirect in that sense, and that often what produces and sort of stabilizes that knowledge of the world is an apparatus, that, you know, there's to get away from thinking it's about the relationship of the subject to an object, there's a thing in the middle, and the thing in the middle is always apparatus. So how do you have a kind of labor and apparatus centered model of how knowledge is produced, where knowledge is then labor? It's just another form of labor, a specialized kind with particular rules and procedures. And Barad, and she does a whole reading of Niels Bohr that's also, again, way beyond my competence, I have to say up front, but not beyond hers, that shows how Bohr is making apparatus a central category. And she sort of says, well, you could sort of expand that a little bit. He sort of thinks really just the apparatus on the bench in the lab, but you can then think about the lab as apparatus, the infrastructure that it runs on, and so forth. And particularly when you get to climate science, the next bit is another person in the orbit of Haraway, which is Paul Edwards. The thing about climate science, you're really looking at a global apparatus that's made up of protocols of scientific collaboration that, you know, took a century to produce, and satellites and computation and fluid dynamics, and like getting all these things to come together to produce a knowledge. So that's where apparatus gets very much away from the bench and out into the world. And it struck me that if you sort of thought through from a couple of selected things in Farabend and quite a fair bit of Haraway and through Barad and then to Edwards, that you had a sort of a line of things that orients you towards thinking about science as a labor that produces knowledge with and by apparatus.
That's great. Thank you so much. And diffraction is actually part of that, right? I mean, I think there's a really beautiful moment in the book on 154, just to mention this for listeners who hopefully will get their own copies and they can look at this, that talks about the kind of meeting of fields, right? The meeting of maybe forms of knowledge, maybe ways of understanding the world. Now, this is, I'm just kind of embellishing this, as a meeting of waves, right, of diffraction patterns. And you talk about Lefebvre, in his work, Henri Lefebvre, the Marxist philosopher, talking about sort of swimming and swimming through waves and finding a rhythm. And I think that's just a really beautiful way of thinking about what it is to make, to create a conversation, basically, and make fields or make people's work speak to each other in a way that moves us away from having to, again, rely on genealogy. So that idea of swimming through the waves, I think, is one that's really going to stick with me. So you mentioned the work of Paul Edward. Or did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I was just going to say that this is also in Haraway's sense of a practice of knowledge as a kind of a gift of images and metaphors for how to think about knowledge in the world, where it doesn't matter if the gift is accepted, and it's not an authoritarian gesture on the part of a philosopher of like, I have the concept that explains everything. It's more, here's an image or a story or a metaphor that might work and might connect us. And, you know, like all gifts, it kind of doesn't matter if it's returned or not.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Thank you. So you've briefly mentioned the work of Paul Edwards. Paul Edwards was one of Haraway's students, as you mentioned in the book, and you take us into his work in the book A Vast Machine, right? And the notion of a kind of, as you've, I think, already talked a little about, a notion of a knowledge infrastructure. It's important for understanding climate science. Now, one of the things that comes out of this that I think is really important for how we understand and practice STS, for example, but also practice a kind of theory in that context, is the way that his work and your use of his work is understanding climate science as it requires a media theory, and specifically is understanding the relationship between data and models, right? So here, one of the things that comes out that I think is really important, many of us, in a very flat-footed way, understand the movement from data to models as kind of data are out there, and then we create models to fit them. And one of the things you're showing here is that they really co-produce each other, right? Can you talk about this as an important part of kind of the overall discussion of labor and the production of knowledge? So I would just invite you to talk, to say a little bit more, if you'd like, about Paul Edwards' work, what he's doing in terms of studying the means of production, right, of data in climate science, and maybe how that articulates with these larger ideas of labor that are animating the book.
Yeah, and of course, Paul Edwards spent years writing this really quite magisterial and empirically and conceptually rich history of climate science, and I just read it and, you know, like, just said a couple of things about it. So it's really all Paul in that sense, although whether he would agree entirely with how I read it's another story. But he does offer this very interesting proposition that one of the things that makes climate science problematic for politics and publics is that it's a simulationist science. So it's about models, and it's about models based in computation, and where because the model runs on essentially on the physics of fluid dynamics, you can use the model to correct the data, right? And the thing about collecting data in climate science is that it's all based on weather data, which can be highly inaccurate. And there's no way to know that, right? How can you have a weather station collect temperature data in the same place for 100 years when the place itself changes, or where somebody changed the thermometer and didn't calibrate the old one to the new one? Like, all of these things become issues in the data sets on which the models are partly built, which then the models then respond to and react to. So we get all sorts of eruptions of crises about this. And I remember one happened in Australia. I'm not going to get the facts entirely right, but it had to do with it's an anecdote, right? So it's climate science is climate science throwing out a couple of super high temperature readings from the 19th century somewhere, and climate denialists are sort of, you know, jumping up and down like, look, it's not real science. They sneakily took these results out, but it seems that the the results are aberrant. They're probably unshielded thermometers or something. They're not representative. And in any case, if you put them back in, it doesn't change the overall results all that much, right? So it's not actually not much hinges on it. So I think there was something really useful in Edwards showing the nature of the science and the nature of the truth claim it makes as being kind of distinctive, that there's something to it being and it's ironic for those of us raised on Jean Baudrillard that here it's the simulation is the thing that's absolutely true, right? And the actual Earth climate is an approximation of the model is how you have to kind of think it in a way. But where, you know, the as with any science, there's differences of view within this overwhelming consensus about, you know, what the trajectory is and what putting this much carbon in the air actually results in. So I thought Edwards was really kind of key in sort of showing, ironically, that this really quite vast technical apparatus that is modernity ends up also then producing a science based on a vast apparatus, a vast machine, as his title has it, that shows why it can't go on, which shows why that very practice is something that has to be modified in some significant way now.
So as we move from here to the last body chapter of the book, we move into a chapter that we could, I mean, as any of the chapters, but really here, we could talk about this for another hour, right? This is a chapter that looks very carefully and very spiritedly at Kim Stanley Robinson's Mars trilogy. Okay, so I'm not going to ask you to summarize what's going on. I will just say, like, at this point in the interview, if listeners want to press pause and go read the Mars trilogy, it's amazing. Everyone should read it and then come back or listen to the rest of this, but definitely put this on your to-read list if you haven't already read it. Listeners should just read the Mars trilogy. Okay, so in this chapter, you take us through Red Mars, Green Mars, and Blue Mars as a way to kind of tie together and extend this conversation that we've been having, certainly in our conversation today, but also insofar as the book creates a conversation that goes all the way back to Bogdanov. So I'm going to keep this fairly open. Ken, for you at this moment right now, what are some of the most exciting ways that the Mars trilogy helps us understand the potential of the ideas that we've been talking about in the book so far? Or sort of put another way, put more simply, in what ways is the Mars trilogy a work about technology, and in what ways does that matter moving forward?
Well, Kim Stanley Robinson, or Stan, as he's known, I think gets it even better in a later book called 2312.
Oh, that was awesome! Yeah,
which is
to read that too.
Yeah. I got it just as I was finishing writing this book. And there's a more recent one, I think it's called Sirius, that's a slightly more pessimistic, you know, sort of meditation on the same thing. It struck me that. And this is, again, a thing that both Bogdanov and Haraway have in common, is that interest in science and science fiction together, and the way that science fiction can have a few different functions. There's certain flavors of science fiction that people in the sciences themselves read or can be encouraged to read, which is kind of interesting because they're, you know, there are characters in it and that kind of thing. So that's useful. It's ways of thinking through problems through some sort of displacement. So, you know, Stan's Mars books, they're, among other things, already about the Anthropocene, even though he wrote them before that was even a thing or even a word. You know, it's another planet you have to try to think through all of the systems of. So there's a way in which science fiction is useful in that sense. You get this sort of slightly displaced object where the real object that's a little too tough or too present to think about, you think about it through a kind of a displaced one. And there's also a way in which it sort of plays out, you know, semi-realistic possibilities. You know, could you know, social and natural organization be different to the one we have? And that, again, is something that I think these books are really terrific for. You know, what are ways of organizing scientific knowledge, cultural knowledge, and labor together? I think that's Stan's great theme. It's like, how do all of those things fit together, and how could they fit together otherwise? So the Mars books are an incredibly rich source for thinking about that.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talk about reading his work, especially Blue Mars, when you talk about that, as an offering of a kind of meta-utopia. So utopia, right? I mean, this is a theme and a figure that threads through the entire book, and we haven't, I think, talked about that too much yet. So as a way of bringing that into the conversation before we move to the conclusion, how does his work offer a kind of meta-utopia? What's a meta-utopia? Mm. And can you talk about the importance for you of utopia and thinking with and about utopia for the project of the book as a whole?
Yeah, I have a slightly unusual take on what utopias are. Like, they're often thought of as either airy-fairy and practical things, or as some really terrible thing that totalitarian states were based on. But I think, particularly in relation to the second of those points, the great utopias are all written after, not before, moments of social terror. And in relation to the first point, I think utopias all came true. Like, they all actually happened, just with certain little details, modified. So they turned out to be an incredibly realistic kind of genre. You know, if you read Charles Fourier, who's the most poetic of the utopians, but compare him to the novels of the era, he's much, much more realistic. He's the only one who asks who takes out the trash. No one else even asked that question. Like, the novel's this fantasy world where food just arrives and, like, no one cleans out the outhouse. It's just a fantasy, whereas Fourier asks real questions about those things, So that's my sort of counterintuitive take on utopia. So I think it's a lively, useful, interesting kind of space. But what Stan does with the Mars books a little different is it's kind of meta-utopia, because it's about all of them at once. The thing is, he tries to sort of think through, is there something from all of the kind of utopian traditions and literatures, and how would they relate to each other? If they all got a chance to be next door to each other, how would they work that out? He even wrote a constitution for Mars that's not actually in the Mars trilogy. It's off in another collection of his, to sort of answer that sort of question. So there's this kind of really quite, on the one hand, quite practical questions in the utopian tradition, as well as a kind of poetics and openness to possibility. But in Stan, that possibility is always to do with real world things. Like, he's interested in how, the physics is at least notionally real, the biology is at least notionally real. Like, there's no magic involved, right? It's all about things that could plausibly happen. So that struck me as a useful way of getting us out of habits of thought. So to go right back to the beginning, if we tend to think the world is just basically an extension of our own little habits, then maybe we're misled into thinking what the world is. And maybe there are literatures that get us out of those habits and see it structured from other people's habits. And that at least would give us some, meta perspective on how the world could be otherwise and how the world could be habitable and endurable.
Great, thank you. Now, in part of what you just said, you mentioned something about the significance of practice, right? The importance of practice. This is something, again, that comes through throughout the book. And it's also something that becomes really interesting when we move to the conclusion, right? Which I think reiterates in indirect and direct ways the importance of practice for what we're doing here. Now, you talk in the conclusion, early on in the conclusion, about your own experience working in the regional party headquarters of the Communist Party of Australia. So just in terms of thinking about how to bring this whole conversation and the book together, why was it important for you to conclude there, right? Like, why is that space? Or can you talk a little bit about your decision to bring us into that space as a way to bring the book together and the project together and move it forward?
It's partly a debt to my early teachers. My first teachers were in the party. That party was a very strange outfit, but it broke with Moscow in 68. So it's kind of like not what people imagine. It's a little hard to explain to Americans what this could possibly ever have been. But I met people who, they were former steelworkers and merchant seamen and things like that. And they thought out of those practices to, what an ideal world could be. And, I sort of really, for all their faults, I still sort of love them for that. Not many of them are still living, though. I was young, they were older. And it was also, you know, Marxist theory comes from practice, right? But particularly in the United States, people who've read Marx read him in graduate school, and I think have a very different understanding of those texts than the one I got from people who whose experience of it was very much about, you know, sort of shop floor organizing and things like that. So I was sort of just paying homage to where I learned those things, and trying to, you know, sort of shed some of the baggage of that past, but retaining that one bit of are there ways that people's labor can cooperatively be combined to make a world we could continue to inhabit? Like that strikes me as a larger goal that people of many different beliefs and ideologies could probably see some merit in.
That's right. And in fact, the penultimate sentence in the book, right before the reiteration of the epigraph that started the book, is, we all know this civilization can't last. Let's make another, right? The sort of call to collectivity. Now, the last thing I want to ask you a little bit about takes off or picks up the thread of something that you just mentioned, right? The importance of understanding this in the context of Marxisms, perhaps, right? If not Marxism. And the story takes place, as you tell us here in the conclusion, within the archives of mutating Marxisms, but involves a series of reversals of perspective. And you take us through these, from bourgeois to proletarian, from schism to system, from molar to molecular. We've talked about that, from high theory to low theory, superstructure to base, genteel to vulgar. And there's one more as well. Now, you also tell us here in the conclusion, or remind us, that labor, in the words of the book, is the mingling of many things, most of them not human. And one of these reversals is from human to inhuman. So perhaps as a way to kind of bring this together, you didn't say from human to non-human. This is human to inhuman. What's the difference, and what's the significance of that difference?
Yeah, there's a way in which the conclusion maybe addresses a smaller audience than the rest of the book does, because it's maybe of not everybody's concern what the internal, you know, sort of struggles in how we might think what the history of Marxism is and what we can do with it. And then the relationship between these three terms, human, inhuman, non-human, is partly a way of thinking through, you know, I think Haraway and Brad and all that are interesting because it's about this middle term, the inhuman. And it was useful for me as a way to sort of fend off the appeal of what's sometimes called speculative realism or object-oriented ontology, which wants to sort of leap directly into the non-human. So that's things that are utterly alien and foreign and don't involve the mixing of human with the non-human. But which to me always ends up being somewhat contemplative and poetic and makes somewhat grand claims for what one can do purely on the basis of theory. So it's why I sort of settle on the inhuman as this immediate space, mediating space. That's is the space where, you know, where things mix and mingle, where practices, you know, sort of forge things together. And that's the only thing I think we can take to be real is our practice of encounter with the world.
That's kind of a perfect note, I think, to end on and to draw this to a conclusion. So, Ken, there's a million billion things we didn't have a chance to talk about. The book is extraordinarily rich, right? And there's so much that we didn't have time to address. But given that, is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about but that you'd like to mention for our listeners?
No, I think only that that book, like some others, are really about my own students in a sense that, you know, it comes out of questions they have and literatures I've tried to find for them. And where the context of the new school, where we're a social science school and also a design school, then sort of plays into it. So it's thinking in between those two categories of practice is what the book ended up being very much about.
Great. So now that the book is out, and congratulations on, I think, what's a fantastic book, at least from my perspective, what's next
for
you? What are you currently working on? What are you inspired by now?
I have a book coming out that's kind of different. It's called General Intellects, and it's sort of maybe doing it does come out of Bogdanov in a sense of trying to think about, like, there's no great public intellectual anymore. Like, you can't look to Jean-Paul Sartre to have all the answers to your questions anymore. You know, like, you need at least 20 people of whom at least half have to not be men, right, to sort of ask questions and have to not all be from Paris to ask questions. But they don't, you know, how do you fit them together? And again, it was a thing that I did working with students, is like, well, you need to know some political theory, but you also need some science studies, and you also need to know about culture. And so how do you work those things together? And so it's a reading of 20, you know, sort of prominent, what I call general intellects rather than public intellectuals. But the thing I'd really love to get done is a book that would be about the middle in between the two halves of Molecular Red. And it's I want to resurrect the British Marxist scientists of the 1930s, which is J.D. Burnell, Joseph Needham, and J.B.S. Haldane. But I want to put them in the context of certain very important women who are around them but end up in different stories. So Haldane's sister, Naomi Mitchison, Haldane's wife, Charlotte Haldane, or rather I should say he was her husband, who kind of invented science journalism, but no one, you know, tells that story. So, you know, I wanted to sort of rethink that moment of the 1930s when it seemed like there was a global emergency. It seemed like we needed to be able to mobilize all sorts of resources. It seemed like we needed to defeat fascism. Maybe we have to do that again. So I'm interested in these flawed characters who made a hell of a lot of mistakes, but who were either first-rate scientists or very interesting writers who were sort of part of that struggle. And to me, that's sort of the missing part between the two halves of Molecular Red. Mm-hmm. And it's got a lot of diffraction in it because Burnell was an X-ray crystallographer, which is all about diffraction. So I sort of get to play with that a bit more. So I'm hoping if I can get a little time, I can sort of thread that story. And parts of that story are well known, but I think that version of it, of putting those things together, has sort of not really quite come out. So hopefully I'll get to do that.
So as someone whose day job is in the history of Chinese science, mention Needham and this is music to my ears, and like, oh my gosh, the women who constellated around him. Please write that book. Please, universe, give Ken time to write that book, and so that I can read that book, because that is also a fabulous project. So thank you so much for taking time away from that to talk with me about this book. It's really been a pleasure. And again, congratulations on great work.
Well, thank you, Carla. It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to the New Books Network Seminar. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.